You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from a new book that takes place in an historic hotel.
The Playboy Club Hotel opened in Lake Geneva in 1968. It became a hub for Midwestern travelers, businessmen, and of course, Playboy bunnies. Author Christina Clancy of Madison has just released a novel called Shoulder Season that takes place at the historic resort. She tells the story of fictional 19-year-old Sherry Taylor, who enters a period of self-discovery while working as a bunny. Here's Clancy reading an excerpt from the book. In this scene, Sherry has just begun her job as a bunny, and she learns that the job is a lot different than she imagined.
Sherry began to understand why Gloria, the bunny mother, didn't want to use the word waitress to describe the work the bunnies had to do. What waitress trained for an entire week or stayed up late trying to memorize the contents of two huge binders that were bigger than the Old Testament? Memorization was easier for Sherry than for most of the other girls. She was able to take a mental picture of just about anything she saw and store it in her brain, but still she was overwhelmed by all the rules Bunny Star ticked through. Don't let guests see you wear jewelry, chew gum, eat, or sit. You'll get demerits for having dirt under your nails, if your ears are bent incorrectly, or if you don't keep the changing room cleaned. You need to look at the bulletin board every day for updates and attend bunny council meetings, and don't ever forget to check the ashtrays. Bunny council sounded important. They had their own employee newsletter called the Hare's Head. Wouldn't her friend Jean be impressed to learn that there was more to Sherry's job than strutting around in a bunny suit? Sherry had underlined a line she'd found in the bunny manual twice, once for herself and once for Jean. The bunny has become what the Ziegfeld girl was to another generation, synonymous with the most glamorous young women in the world. She was part of a tradition. She was finally part of something. Sherry even got benefits. She felt like a real adult filling out her forms for accident, life, and health insurance. She had a week's paid vacation and a free subscription to Playboy magazine that she could read 2 weeks before the subscribers. Guests could practically eat for free with Sherry's family discount, but this perk only made Sherry sad that she didn't know anyone who would visit her. Sherry was told she'd be welcome at the Playboy clubs in Chicago, and Los Angeles, and all over the world. When she heard this, she smiled at Bunny Rhonda. "We should go to Chicago." "That's okay," Rhonda said. "I went there on a school field trip to see the King Tut exhibit. I couldn't stand all the shadows." "The shadows?" "From the skyscrapers. The middle of the day in the city feels like the middle of the night. The L is so loud. I'd be fine if I never went back there again. The loudest thing I hear in Barneveld is a screech owl. That's enough for me." The most important rule, and the one that bothered Sherry the most, was that bunnies were forbidden from dating not just co-workers, but also key holders and guests. The women broke out in a collective groan when they heard this. "Oh, we're disappointingly moral here," Bunny Star said in a voice that could break up a party. Disappointing was right. Sherry had had a million crushes on the boys at school, and she'd daydreamed about encounters with celebrities like Leif Garrett and Sean Cassidy. Her notebook was filled with the signature combined with the last name of whichever boy she liked at the time. Sherry Parker, Sherry McBride, all with a heart as the dot for the I in Sherry. But aside from Tommy, she'd had little experience. She didn't know how to flirt, much less act sexy. She'd hoped to change all that. Wasn't the resort supposed to be the sexiest place on earth? But with all the rules, she felt like the mystique around Playboy was a total lie. Rhonda seemed relieved, while Sherry felt she'd been betrayed. "We may as well have joined a nunnery," she whispered to Bunny Ginger. "Don't worry," Ginger winked. "I heard there are ways to have fun."
That was author Christina Clancy reading from her new novel, Shoulder Season, which tells the fictionalized tale of working at the once very real Playboy Club Hotel in Lake Geneva. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the night sky and meteor showers. The Draconids are reaching their peak, and the Orionid meteor shower will be at its best later this month. We're learning about the timing, the intensity of these two October meteor showers. With your questions along the way about the night sky, 800-642-1234. Gene Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Gene, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Great to be with you.
So how about we do your favorite thing first before we discuss the night sky calendar? If you will, explain to us what is a meteoroid and then what is a meteor shower?
Well, these are the M words, right?
Yes.
So a meteoroid is a term we use for things that are traveling in the void of space. That's how I remember which one is which. And that means we don't have to specify, was this a piece of a comet or a piece of an asteroid? Because it could be either. So these are pieces of debris that are floating through space. And when they hit our atmosphere and make the air around them glow, we call them meteors. We also say shooting stars, falling stars, that's all the same thing. If something hits the ground and we might pick it up, we call it a meteorite. Now, you asked me about meteor showers. We get meteors all the time, a few an hour on average if you're in a dark spot. But sometimes we get many more because the Earth crosses the path of a comet. And then we can predict. We know, oh, there's going to be more debris, and therefore there'll be more meteors, and they tend to come from the same direction in the sky.
Is this how you call them, warm leftovers?
Yes, warm leftovers, because both asteroids and comets are leftovers from when the solar system was forming. So the warm leftovers are asteroids because they're closer to the sun and they're rocky. And the frozen leftovers, the cold stuff, is comets that are much farther from the sun.
And certainly, I would also carry water or help us with water.
Yes, so comets might have even brought not only some of the water on our planet, but possibly even the first kind of specks of life.
The average asteroid, you've said, has the mass of a grain of rice? How on Earth can we see it then?
Hold on. The piece of debris. So the those tend to be little things, right? Like grains of rice or peas. Asteroids, of course, what gives birth to these itty bitty little things are bigger than
much
that.
Much bigger.
They can be, many miles across.
Okay. So this weekend's viewing of the Draconids meteor shower, can you give us what we should anticipate? What should we look for?
Sure. So this particular meteor shower is emanating, if you will, from the Draco constellation. Most of these meteor showers get their name from the constellation that they seem to come from.
Mm-hmm.
This is a constellation that's in the north, and it kind of hovers between the Big and the Little Dipper. Do you think it would be useful to remind people what to look for the Big and the Little Dipper?
Yes,
okay,
please.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
So I like to think of the Big Dipper as a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle. And that's going to be in the northwest. It's fairly low. So if you have a lot of buildings or tall trees in that direction, you might not be able to see it. So try and get yourself, clear horizon along the northwest side of your wherever you're looking at. Now, if you imagine that shopping cart, the two front stars are called the pointer stars. If you extend them about five times, you hit the North Star. So the dragon's tail travels between the pointer stars and the North Star, wraps around the Little Dipper, which also looks like a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle, smaller, of course, than the Big Dipper. And then we see a loop-de-loop and a head. Now, you may or may not see all of what I'm describing, especially if you're in the city. If you're not away from city lights, it might be hard to see even the Little Dipper. But what you can use as kind of your guideline is the North Star. There's a super bright star closer to the horizon called Arcturus that looks like an airplane. It's so bright. And there's also another star called Vega. The area of interest is between those three bright stars that I mentioned, Vega, Arcturus, and the North Star.
Gotcha. So we kind of have our coordinates, if you will. You know, Draconid, this meteor shower, sometimes it's great and sometimes it's not, I understand.
That is true for all meteor showers, to be perfectly candid, so I don't want to set up our listeners for disappointment. As far as I'm concerned, if you see between 5 and 10 an hour, that's pretty good. That's not to write home about, I understand. But the thrill of seeing something that's traveled through space, in some cases for years, hitting the top of our atmosphere and saying hello to you should be a wonderful experience. I would advise to bring something comfortable a lawn chair is perfect because you can look up. You want to find an area with as big a horizon as you can manage it. Because, like, nicely, they're not limited only to that area of sky that I suggested you find, but you get big streaks that can cover large swaths of the sky.
And I understand that, you know, usually it's right after midnight or so that is a best viewing option, but this meteor shower would be earlier, maybe perhaps in the evening hours.
Which makes it sweeter. Right?
Yes, especially for the kiddos.
That's right. You don't have to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Most of us working folks can't really do that. But this one is visible after sunset. So when it's nice and dark, that is when it's best, and that is unusual. So that makes this particular meteor shower, I think, even more friendly to, you know, to most of us.
We're discussing the slate of fall meteor showers with Jean Creighton, the head of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in. Are you excited about the fall season for meteor showers? Are you a watcher, a stargazer? Where do you observe the night sky? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with astronomer Jean Creighton here on the Ideas Network. We're maximizing our viewing of meteor showers, finding out what to expect from the night skies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We've been talking about the Draconids meteor shower appears every October, and unlike most meteor showers, it occurs earlier in the night. It makes it easier for the kiddos to appreciate shooting stars across the sky. Still time for your meteor and constellation questions with longtime astronomer Jean Creighton of UW-Milwaukee. We're at 800-642-1234. Jean with us for about 9 more minutes. So, besides the Draconids, what other meteor showers might be able to catch this fall and into the winter?
The Orionids are going to peak around the 21st of October. And the other famous one is the Leonids that peak mid-November. By the time we hit the Geminids, even though they're quite good, they peak from the 13th to the 14th of December. And at that point, the weather has become not only unpredictable in terms of whether we have precipitation or not, but it's also usually cold enough that you really don't want to be sitting around for extended periods of time in the night sky. But for right now, if you think about it, the nature is giving us relatively manageable warm evenings. You might, as you wait for the dark to settle, you can enjoy the beautiful fall colors. So you get nature in all its glory, both on Earth and in the sky.
And I know you're kind of partial to the Orionids. Where do you put the stress on that one? Orionids? Orionids?
Well, I would say Orionids, but
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you see, I speak Greek, right? So I'm thinking of Orionis. I'm thinking of the constellation. So in addition to the cool meteor showers that, you know, they are unpredictable, so they deliver small or big, and that depends on many things. There are two things you can count on, and that is two planets. Beautiful. Jupiter and Saturn are going to be visible in the southwest. Nice and bright and high. Jupiter is going to be the much brighter of the two. I like to say that if you see an airplane that's moving, that is an airplane. If you see an airplane that's still, that's Jupiter. Jupiter is going to be much brighter than Saturn. And if you have even a modest pair of binoculars or a small telescope, it's possible to see the moons of Jupiter.
All right. So, you know, binoculars or the naked eye, you know, we can see some things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the moon is kind to us today because it's going to set relatively early in the evening. I mean, it's a crescent. It's beautiful to behold in any case, but it also will set, so it won't interfere with your shower viewing.
So does the speed of the meteorite matter to our ability to actually observe it?
Not really. No,
okay.
These guys, you'll see a flash of light. If the original debris, we talked about how typically they're like, as you say, grains of rice. But if there's something like a size of an orange, then you get what's called a fireball. And that can, I've seen a few of those, and they're really pretty because they last more than just a couple seconds. They linger in because they're big enough that it takes longer for the debris to disintegrate as it enters the atmosphere. Those are pretty cool.
Oh, I love the analogy to oranges because, you know, just think about how tiny and momentary that is that we see that meteor, and that's a fireball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, and I know you often get asked this question, but since we're here, how big was the meteor that killed the dinosaurs?
Oh, much, much bigger. so that would have been, the crater that made it is miles across, right?
Mm-hmm.
We found that we think it's the Yucatan Peninsula. That would have been, you know, more than half a mile across. So that is a whole nother level. Happily, we don't get those too often because, you know, that definitely is a problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to end on a sour note, but let me just say that we are, in fact, tracking anything of that size. So there are about 8,000 objects that we're tracking just because they have the capacity of threatening life on Earth as we know it. And the hope is that we understand how things move, and if there's anything that gets too close to the Earth, we're exploring options of what we would do about it. And one of the ideas we have is to alter their orbits so that they miss the Earth by thousands of miles.
We're talking with Gene Creighton, who is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Appreciating astronomy with your questions, 800-642-1234. We heard from Sharon in Lac-des-Flambeaux, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Sharon was in Georgia and saw a giant meteor during the day and wonders how big does a meteor have to be seen during the day?
It could, you know, it doesn't have to be all that big. It could be literally the size of an orange or a little bigger. It doesn't have to be that big because that can outshine the moon. These fireballs, in some definitions, a fireball is by definition something that's brighter than the moon. You would see that during the day if you're looking in the right direction.
Yeah. Can you see meteors on a regular night if the sky is clear and dark?
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have just random debris all the time hitting the atmosphere. What makes meteor showers special is that usually they're more than average. So typical, you'll get five an hour anyway. But the nice also thing is that they're concentrated in a particular part of the sky, or they seem to radiate from a particular part of the sky rather than just being any place at, you know, kind of randomly distributed all across the sky.
Yeah, because having a little bit of anticipation, knowing where to look and when to look is certainly helpful. You know, the pandemic has really been difficult for planetariums around the state, around the country, and you're back open. What kind of events are you hosting? How are you doing this?
We're having still a mix of virtual and live programming. You're right, it has been difficult. On the plus side, I realize that there really is value in offering virtual programming because a lot of the people who join us may not be able to travel or live out of state, so they couldn't come this far or even off the continent. So that's been fun to offer programming that's really accessible to a very large audience. After all, I couldn't have 10,000 people join me for anything in a planetarium that fits 75 people. But it is, of course, absolutely marvelous to have live programming again. We had Salsa Dancing Under the Stars last Friday, and that was live, and we had salsa lessons just in order to honor Hispanic Heritage Month. And to continue that theme, we have Cultural Celestialis program about the connections between cultures in South America and Central America with the sky. Mm. So, for example, today we have a program on Peru. Next week we'll have a program on Brazil. And the nice thing about a virtual program is that our speakers can be elsewhere. Our Brazilian is going to join us from Brazil. We have a program also on Chile and Puerto Rico.
Oh, Jean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. What a pleasure to talk about the beautiful sky with you today.
I appreciate it. Jean Creighton, director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. Stay with us for a conversation about cybersecurity, ransomware attacks, and what can be done about a staffing shortage in the field, as well as a brush up on our own password hygiene. Have you changed your passwords, by the way? I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.